everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, the topic is the psychology and the reality and threats of climate change, malignant normality, our resilience to survive, and the legacy of one of America's great minds. It's important to understand that there are people who have original thoughts, then there are people who have original thoughts that cause us to pause and reflect upon what they've shared with us. My guest is one, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, L-I-F-T-O-N. He is a distinguished pioneering psychiatrist, a longtime anti-nuclear war scholar and activist. He has been investigating the psychological impacts of warfare and terrorism and nuclear weapons and political violence and coercive thought reform and brainwashing for six decades. Along with his mentor, the famous developmental psychologist Eric Erickson, and others, he formed the Wellfleet Psychohistory Group that investigated the motivations for war and genocide. And for a time in the early 1960s, Dr. Lifton lived in Hiroshima, studying the psychological traumas of the survivors of the nuclear bomb and later the violence and trauma perpetrated on Vietnamese from exposure to Agent Orange. His book on Nazi medical doctors was groundbreaking for identifying how normal people can rationalize and support such atrocities and crimes against humanity. Earlier in the 1950s, he had studied the impact of thought reform and brainwashing on POW's mental health in Chinese prisons. He and another colleague successfully lobbied to have post-traumatic stress disorder recognized as a clinical diagnosis, and he has been a teacher and researcher at the Washington School of Psychiatry, Harvard University, John Jay College. He's written many important books based upon his research, and he is the author of The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. And he is among the leading psychologists leading the charge to warn Americans of Trump's abnormal mental condition. His website is robertjlifton.com. Nice to have on our program.
Thank you.
Your more recent focus on climate change has largely been influenced by your investigations into the global dangers of nuclear weapons and war during the past 60 years. You said it's difficult for you to look at the nuclear threat without looking at the climate and vice versa. In the case of the Cold War's nuclear arms race, humanity was faced with the possibility of its bringing about its own self-annihilation. And again, with the anthropogenic climate change, we are again faced with another extinction scenario. You've called these nuclear war and climate change the apocalyptic twins. You also speak at length about mindset, the role worldviews and self-perceptions play into how individuals and political parties or ideologies and tribes, as it were, proactively fail to act on these potentially catastrophic events. So I feel it is a good place to begin by asking you to explain the psychological dimensions that give rise to the different opposing mindsets on climate change, and please relate this to your observations and research into how the threats of an escalation of nuclear weapons and their use have been treated, because, again, President Trump has taken us into a new Cold War, and that has created a pervasive atmosphere and a new nuclear arms race that was actually started by President Bush when he withdrew the U.S. from international treaties, and again under President Obama. Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize and then turns around and allocates $1.5 trillion, with a T, for a new nuclear arsenal, and yet the existing nuclear arsenal is still the largest in the world and fully capable of a total world annihilation. So you have to ask, who's behind Bush? Who's behind Obama? Who's behind Clinton? Who's behind Trump to demand that we posture ourselves at Russia's doorsteps and China and Iran, someone else is behind this. The form is yours.
Well, you're asking the large questions, as you should. Let me start with a very simple idea. When I called my book The Climate Swerve, and then a subtitle of Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival, I was talking about, believe it or not, a very faint note of hope. That is, what I write about in this book, despite all the dangers, and with the apocalyptic twins always looming as end-of-the-world possibilities, despite all that, what I mean by the climate swerve is a relatively recent capacity on the part of virtually all human beings to recognize that we are members of a single species in deep trouble. That's the ideal that was expressed at Paris in 2015. The climate swerve, then, is an irregular, not always expected, not exactly manageable tendency toward recognizing the truths of climate threat. So that's what I mean by the climate swerve. Now, having said that, of course, you've raised lots of problems, as I do in my book and elsewhere, about carrying through what's necessary to do if we're to avoid destroying our own civilization. And I start the book with what I call an ultimate absurdity. And that is, very simply, that if we continue to do what we're doing in relationship to the use of fossil fuels without changing anything, you don't have to have any weapons come into the world, you don't have to take any special actions, just continue doing what we're doing, we would threaten our entire civilization by the end of this century. Nothing could be more absurd than that situation. And in a way, it was the extremity of this absurdity that created something that's never happened in the world. An event at Paris in 2015 in which every single nation in the world recognized that we humans are capable of doing ourselves in through climate, through our contribution to climate change, and each assumed a commitment to reduce its spewing of carbon into the atmosphere, which is, of course, the source, the major source of the danger. That was the response by means of a climate swerve, response to the extremity that we, the ultimate absurdity that we find ourselves in. I could say a word now about this funny word, swerve. You know, there's a book by a Harvard classicist, a very interesting book called The Swerve, which is about the emergence of the modern from the time of the Renaissance involving Lucretius. And it was Lucretius, the ancient Roman poet and philosopher, who termed the word swerve because he found that the particles which he thought made up all of matter, everything, would suddenly take a different, or would at some point take a different direction that was unpredictable, but formidable in its impact. And this has been converted to consciousness or awareness. And that's what seems to be happening. And that's what I mean by the swerve. There are lots of, I came upon it because I had been confronting nuclear danger for a very long time, for many decades. And I came to interact, observe, meet people who were involved in either nuclear danger or climate threat. And I began to realize that there was a profound relationship between them. The primary relationship is that they are both end of the world possibilities. They both take on the apocalyptic narrative. At the same time, I hadn't really been aware of their connection or of how to think about climate danger over many of these years that I had been studying nuclear weapons. And finally, somewhat belatedly, I came to recognize that you really can't confront one without the other. So maybe this is a beginning to this effort on my part to approach climate danger, the climate threat, by means of a comparison with the nuclear threat, both in terms of parallels and differences. So that's perhaps enough for an introductory statement about what the book is about.
I appreciate your overview. Thank you. I do not think that the general population today perceives the full danger in the new nuclear arms race with Russia, and now with other countries such as Israel, who in a heartbeat, Netanyahu would cause a nuclear confrontation with Iran. That would not go well. Pakistan, North Korea, India, and China, these are all politically unstable, and they have people who are not looking for true diplomacy and to disarm, but rather are doubling down. And we've seen this repeatedly. And then you have to look at why the media has not spoken up in any harsh terms or providing real truths about what would happen in any form of nuclear exchange. To the contrary, both on the left and the right, there has been a prevailing view through the official corporate Democrat and corporate Republican parties, whether it's Hillary Clinton's group or Obama's group, which was Hillary Clinton's group.
Let me say something about what you're raising now more generally. The very existence of nuclear weapons in the world by any nuclear weapons possessor represents a grave danger. We human beings aren't constituted with sufficient wisdom that's always sustained that would enable us to be secure in the stockpiling of nuclear weapons. Of course, there's always the possibility of an escalating political conflict. There's the possibility of human error, of technological error, and the only relatively safe situation in relation to nuclear weapons, and this goes to, this applies to every single country that possesses them, is getting rid of them. And that's what the really more basic anti-nuclear movement has been advocating for many decades. Even if we got rid of them, of course, there would be the possibility of recreating them, but the world would indeed be a radically safer place. There's nobody who should be or can be entrusted with nuclear weapons. That's the more general statement I would make. I would also say, though, that the anti-nuclear movement might seem discouraged because we still very much have the danger of nuclear war. Perhaps it's greater than it was during the Cold War. Many people think that. It certainly is very real. And yet it's quite possible that the anti-nuclear movement, it was a kind of nuclear swerve toward recognizing just what you said, the media don't often enough emphasize the utter destructiveness, the revolution in killing that nuclear weapons represent. And that was realized very widely with enormous intensity during the early 80s, as you may remember, when there were a million people marching in Central Park. And it just could be that the nuclear swerve, the increasing recognition of the revolution in killing that these weapons represent, despite the nuclear hawks, that this recognition of their danger has been an important factor in their not having been used since Nagasaki in August 1945. So this is the more general view about nuclear weapons, and with there's no guarantee they won't be used. There's no guarantee that what I call the modestly hopeful aspects of the climate swerve will protect us from profound climate disaster. There's no guarantee at all. But what one can say, since my book is about a mindset, it's not about, my book is not about the science and not about the politics primarily of climate change, although it has to recognize those and say something about them. It's about the mindset. And the mindset of climate danger, which has only recently taken hold in a very wide fashion, is exactly that which we need to take the necessary steps to mitigate the danger by reducing radically the carbon and methane that we spew into the environment. So it's kind of a dynamic that goes in both directions. I want us to take seriously what I call the swerve, because it's so crucial that we build on it. And let me say one more thing about, you mentioned Trump, and how can one not? We have called them climate deniers. I say in my book, and I feel strongly, that that's no longer an accurate term. They're climate rejectors. It's impossible to live in the world without some sense of climate danger. That has to do with the swerve I mentioned. It has to do with many things that affect us.
But I appreciate that. I understand where you're going with this. I'm going to give you a larger question now that concerns me, because more than 10 years ago, I met with Richard Gale, and I said, Richard, we need to do something that is not being done in the media. We need to do really good scholarship on the subject of climate change, but also all of the environment that could be impacted, not just the heat, but also acidification of the oceans and acid rain and deforestation, all the things cumulatively that cause the degradation of our planet. And we agreed at that time that we would do, on a weekly basis, inputs on environment. Now, I have a very progressive radio audience. In fact, it's the number one progressive radio program in the world. You have more people right now who are progressive-minded listening to you than any other radio station there is. So you start with the basis that people are coming together to harmonize on some basic fundamental observations, that at that time we had a few tipping points. We have 12 tipping points, and now we have over 40. And I was told by the professor whose real-life character Jeff Goldblum played in the movie Jurassic Park, the chaos theorist, and I asked him, I said, can you or anyone with certainty at this moment say that we're not going to have any cataclysmic or such unique and extreme events within our lifetimes? He said, no, that's not possible. I said, then do you believe that we are in chaos theory? This is 8 years ago. He said, oh, we're definitely in chaos theory, and anyone who tells you otherwise is not being honest. Now, that's one point. So one of the leading chaos theorists in the world says we're in chaos theory. Separately, We have gone out of our way to find every leading environmental expert and climate change expert, whether the public's aware of them or not, these are top-grade people. And to a person, every single one has said the same thing. We are not able to stop most of what's going to happen because we're getting into negative feedback loops. So when you have the Arctic melting, which it is, and melting faster than any mathematical model ever projected, which it is, then once that Arctic is completely free of ice, for at least 3 weeks, you're going to have cataclysmic chain events starting to occur where you won't be able to grow wheat in North Dakota as easily as you could. It doesn't mean that the world comes to an end. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that we begin to create feedback loops that nothing will stop them from that point forward. And so we then began to look at people's feedback loops and found that there's at least 22 feedback loops as we speak right now that have tipped. Nothing in the world is going to change that. Nothing. And these are going to be tipping to the degree that we have at least 100,000 extreme weather events per year. Now, the last 3 years, we've had about 100,000 per year. Example, this year, in just the United States in the last 6 months, we had the worst rain in Mississippi's history, the worst rain and storms in Texas history, the worst storm in Florida history.
Well, I live in Florida.
I'm getting to it. So yeah. We're having events that the average person was told would not happen. Now that they have happened here and around the world, I do not see in the general population who've actually been affected by fires in California or elsewhere, I haven't seen a mindset that would suggest that maybe they should do something personally or demand politicians do something at other levels that would help them. I do not see anything but a malaise or an indifference on the part of not climate change denialists, just people who are not interested in it. That's the point.
Okay, well, it's a fair claim. There is by no means the appropriate feelings and intensity that would be necessary for us to really confront this issue. I say toward the end of my book that it is always and never too late. But now, of course, it's imaginable that it could become too late and we can do ourselves in, and that's that. What I'm confronting in the book and looking toward is the path through a mindset and a changed mindset that might diminish the damage and enable us to continue to function in our habitat, however imperfectly. It's all too easy to reduce the whole thing to impossibility. And of course it's very late. It's extremely late to be acting. We should have acted decades ago. Certainly there was national awareness from 1988 and some before that of the nature of climate change and our own contribution to it. But having said that, it's our responsibility to struggle, to act, to do what we can do. Yes, there's a lot of indifference. There's also a lot of human energy in relation to various forms of adaptation. And I delimit two kinds of adaptation in my work on this and in my book. One is the adaptation for coping with the climate change that's already happening. Of course, climate change is no longer simply a projection into the future. It's with us now. Its effects are with us, and we're struggling with it. But that's necessary, but it's not enough. the kind of adaptation that's required is the actual mitigation. That becomes a species adaptation. In a way, either we do it as a species or we don't do it at all, because there aren't limits or borders or boundaries. Climate change is the one all-encompassing threat. So yes, there's a lot of indifference or failure to respond, but there's much more response, and by all studies, a greater sense of awareness of climate change in the last decade than has ever existed, and maybe more so in the last 5 or 7 years. I speak of the difference between different kinds of awareness, between what I call fragmentary awareness and formed awareness. There's still a lot of now fragmentary awareness, an image of glaciers melting or of terrible floods or of droughts or of mudslides or of all the forms of extreme climate events that are profoundly affected by climate change. There's more and more a tendency in contrast to that toward what I call formed awareness. And again, that's what Paris was about, at least in its mindset. And formed awareness is a narrative. There is climate change. We contribute to it. Carbon contributes to it centrally. And this is what we must do in relation to reducing carbon and embracing renewable fuels instead of the fossil fuels to avoid catastrophe. There is a much greater awareness of that narrative than there ever has been. And this is our hope. This is what we must struggle to embrace and work from. Nothing is guaranteed, but we're less than responsible. Even those of us who observe trends are being less than responsible if we don't ourselves take strong action and encourage and insist that others do. Of course, climate scientists have a right to be deeply concerned and even despairing. They've been, in some ways, crying in the wilderness for a long time. They are what I call witnessing professionals. They've warned us, they've told us, and we've responded in the haphazard way that human beings do. And we're struggling to increase that response. It comes from different areas. Again, the modestly hopeful side of this is that the climate swerve is powerful in itself. And even someone like Trump, who, as I said, is better characterized as a climate resister than a climate denier. A climate resister because he and those like him cannot deal with the truth of climate change without questioning their own worldview and their own identity and their own donors. So he rejects, as do many others, climate change, but it's not so easy to reject it, even for him. There was an outburst of outrage in the whole world, including governors and mayors in this country, when he tried to pull us out of Paris. And believe it or not, we're still not outside of Paris. But when there was this worldwide outrage, the White House responded by saying, well, we're not out. It takes 3 years. That's true, according to the rules. Anyhow, we'll send representatives to the meetings. And also, if we can get better negotiations, maybe we'll go back in. Of course, that would mean negotiating with themselves since each country declared its own its own process of mitigation, how much it would do and how it would do it. So it's not easy to overcome, even for Trump and his ilk, the climate swerve. And we're in the middle of a struggle. That's the way I see it. And of course, the scientists have a right to their grave forebodings because, yes, there can reach a level where it becomes increasingly difficult because of feedback mechanisms, as you mention it, to avoid catastrophe. Our task now is to do everything we can in the service of avoiding catastrophe and sustaining our habitat. And when I mentioned the two kinds of adaptation, when we try to adapt to areas that are most prone to climate change, that further tends to deepen the awareness on the part of those seeking this adaptation of the larger problem of the apocalyptic aspects of climate change that threaten to do us in. So these are the avenues of possibilities that we have, despite the very grave dangers that you mention and I also mention.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Would you explain to us what you termed, I'd not heard this before, malignant normality, based upon your earlier studies into the psychological profiles of Nazi doctors and physicians who were likely clinically normal, but were able to rationalize and support the Nazi participation in horrible atrocities and perverse medical experiments and genocide. But one little note on that, I interviewed some of the pilots who sit in a very air-conditioned, nice place out in the Nevada desert and do drone warfare for the United States government. And they seem completely normal on all regards. But then when you ask them, do you know who you're really killing? And they don't.
How do you rationalize
that?
I came to the idea of malignant normality from the best possible source, the Nazis. I studied Nazi doctors, and one illustration of malignant normality is that a German doctor assigned to Auschwitz was expected to carry out the selections that sent 90% of arriving Jews and others to the gas chamber. Actually, the selections were mainly for Jews, but lots of other people were sent to the gas chamber as well. In any case, that was what was expected of him. That was the norm, the routine. That was his job. Now, Nazi doctors varied in how much they were able to plunge right into this or in what kinds of conflicts they had about it. And I wrote about this in my book on Nazi doctors. But the vast majority of them carried out that expected behavior. So that's what I call, now, the expected behavior of people in many different ways in Nazi Germany was malignant because it was associated with killing and with brutal behavior and with various forms of victimization. Of course, it's not just the Nazis who are capable of malignant normality. I talk at length in this book and elsewhere even more about the malignant normality of nuclear weapons, and I choose our own example here in the United States. The malignant normality of nuclear weapons, I divided into three kind of stages. They don't fit in exactly, but in general. The early Cold War stockpiling of nuclear weapons on our part and that of the then Soviet Union, with these projections by people like Herman Kahn and Edward Teller and others of fighting and surviving and winning a nuclear war. Scheller said that the lesson of Hiroshima was that we should never stop making nuclear weapons. It was the exact opposite from the lesson that I took from it. In any case, that was nuclear normality. And as I write in various places, it was even a commission in the early Cold War years of esteemed American professionals and theologians and doctors, including psychiatrists, which had the purpose of helping the American people to recognize that we have to stockpile weapons, that we might have to use them, and not to be too overcome by the fear of annihilation. That's a very malignant notion of normality that professionals were enlisted to deepen. And then we had the duck and cover drills in the schools in the 50s and 60s, in which six-year-old kids knew better than to put their head under a desk or under a sheet of paper to protect them from radiation would save their lives, but they were terrified, of course. In any case, that was a wave of nuclear normality. There was another wave of nuclear normality that came out of Harvard and their flagship book called Living with Nuclear Weapons, another book called Owls, Doves, and what was the third one? Well, there were these three kinds of observers of nuclear weapons, hawks. Hawks were people they were critical of in this Harvard group because hawks wanted too many of nuclear weapons and were too ready to use them. They were also critical of doves because doves didn't want any nuclear weapons and put their country in a weak position when they had negotiations with other countries. The true wise ones were the owls, whom they represented. The owls said not too many nuclear weapons, not too few, and we should try to avoid using them unless we have to. And of course, the whole theory of deterrence included the possibility of using nuclear weapons under certain conditions to remain the credibility of deterrence. That's the broad second wave. All this was to be normalized, was to be America's malignant nuclear normality. And the third wave is the obvious one, SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, using anti-missile missiles to shoot down nuclear weapons. There's one problem with that. It doesn't work. You never can have a perfect scheme of anti-missile missiles, or there'll be just a few that'll get through, perhaps, but that's enough. It can even be enough to initiate nuclear winter and come close to destroying every life on the planet. So these were terrible waves of nuclear normality. We see it in climate normality and the ultimate absurdity I mentioned in terms of just doing what we're doing, which would eventually bring about civilizational catastrophe. So we see all kinds of malignant normality in other things we do, and that includes another subject I've been interested in, the use of torture during the Iraq era and the participation of psychologists with a certain backing from their own professional organization in their expectation they would be in the enhanced interrogations, which spilled over into torture. That became normalized, though finally, interestingly and admirably, there was a rebellion from within the American Psychological Association that forced the APA, the American Psychological APA, to change its policy. But malignant normality is open to everyone, and now we have it during the Trump era, where repetitious lying and falsehoods become normalized, become part of the social, part of society, really. they're hard to remove, even though this is an example of what I call solipsistic reality, the reality which a man like Trump experiences only through what his self experiences and needs. It's a bizarre kind of process. And then, of course, there are followers who don't care about his lies, who embrace them or at least ignore them. And yet, I think it's quite possible that this solipsistic reality will do him in, and so that he is far from certain of finishing his term of office. So these are examples, and I think it's our task, and I say this in various places, our task as witnessing and activist professionals, our task of combining scholarship and activism to confront, expose, and combat malignant normality. And that's what a lot of people are trying to do. And it's certainly the purpose of my work, or the effort in my work, however, inadequate my or other people's efforts may be.
I would like to continue with this thought on malignant normality that you're sharing with us, because it extends into so many other areas of your work. And so often the federal government and the military will downplay the full extent of its actions. For example, the safety of depleted uranium, the use of Agent Orange across the landscape of Vietnam, the huge numbers of civilian deaths, invasions of Afghanistan and Iraqi people, and now more recently our support for the genocide occurring in Yemen. So often wrongs are committed, but instead of becoming transparent and apologizing, learning some lesson from them for the harm and destruction caused, our government rationalizes them and therefore runs away from guilt. What should this tell us about the resilience of the human psyche to violence, war, atrocities, and destruction? And in your estimation, what role has the American media and entertainment industries played in numbing the human mind to accept horrible actions as simply normal behavior?
Well, when I finished my study of Nazi doctors, which was in a way the closest to hands-on evil of a vast dimension that I came to in my work. When I finished that study, people would, you can still hear me, can't you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. People would ask me, okay, you've studied the Nazi doctors, now what do you think about human beings? And they expected me to say, well, not very much. My answer was, and is, we're capable of going either way. There's nothing in our wiring that guarantees collegial and cooperative behavior. And there's nothing in our wiring, in my view, that guarantees pure or primary destructiveness. We can go either way, and that depends a lot on our ideologies and our behavior, the groups we form, the collective principles we embrace. So it's a continuous struggle. Sometimes students or friends will say to me, look, we did these actions, we opposed these evils, and they're still there. What's the purpose of it, of our opposition? And my answer always is there's never a Sartori moment where everything is solved and we're on our way to complete harmony. In fact, there's never a Sartori moment of absolute solution for any great problem. It's in the nature of the vast problems that confront us that they're not fully soluble. So we have to apply our energies to do what we can. There's a wonderful phrase by Suzanne Langer, who was a great biological philosopher, and she said, the organism does what it can. Well, sometimes the organism can even do more than it thought it could, as I could observe and some others in the velvet revolutions of the late 80s and early 90s. And we are all engaged, and this book is another expression of mine to be offered to this struggle to sustain what is possible of decent human behavior and combat what is possible of destructive human behavior. So it's continuous and never ending. That's the larger point.
I appreciate that insight. I would also ask you to address the level of hypocrisy in our opinion leaders and policy makers. And I'll just give you one example. Whether you support or don't support gun control, something has to be done because of the type of violence being committed, and we're not looking at the entirety of the problem and the underlying causes. And yet here are all the celebrities coming forward and saying, you know, how bad guns are, and we shouldn't have them. And at the same time, there were 500 armed policemen protecting them at the Oscars. Plus, every single celebrity has their own armed private bodyguards wherever they go. And yet they want everyone else to be disarmed. Now, I'm not saying for or against arms. That's each individual's choice. I'm saying there's a level of hypocrisy there that we gave Leonardo DiCaprio an award for environmental activism, and he flew from the Cannes Film Festival to New Jersey in a private jet to pick up the award for helping the environment. We're permeated with hypocrisy.
It's just a different emphasis. I'm not taking issue with what you said. I've been much concerned with this issue, though I haven't. I've only written one small piece about what I call gunism. And I think, of course, it's a mixture. Well, let me start by saying I knew Richard Hofstadter, the great American historian, not well, but would have conversations with him from time to time. And the last conversation I had with him, he said to me, in his years of studying American history, the most dispiriting experience has been his recognition of America's inability to come to terms with guns. And he meant not only the guns, but all the paranoia, which he wrote about in association with the guns. I think in some strange way, from early in our history, guns were embraced to combat slaves and free slaves, and also as what was called an equalizer in a society that didn't have a classical culture. Everybody could be equal if he or she had a gun or several guns. So, and you have this anti-government strain. All governing and governance is bad, and guns are part of that. Taking the idea of the gun for militias that should not be controlled by a government into an expanded and ridiculous Second Amendment right. And then there's the commercial side, which is wild and out of hand, where that psychological embrace of guns becomes combined with high capitalism of gun sales. And that's where we find ourselves now. So it's a major overwhelming problem. There are going to be many more gun disasters just by dint of the numbers of guns in our society. And yes, it takes more radical approaches to resolutions, to a resolution than any that have been embraced. But it's got to be embraced, and it's a serious problem beyond any single episode of shooting in a school.
I'd like for you to address something based upon your deep experience in the psychological and behavioral sciences. What role do you believe, if any, the violence permeating the entertainment media has on young developing minds and the proclivity to either desensitize them to violence they or others might do, or to potentize them towards becoming more violent? Do you see any causal or casual relationship?
It's hard to gauge exactly. There has to be some relationship, I believe. I don't think the media are a primary cause of American violence. I think they reflect American violence, but I also think they exploit it. And in their exploitation, they could be playing a very dubious role with people who are on the brink, who have difficulty differentiating imaginary violence and actual violence, or who have a strong inclination toward violence. So I don't think it's primarily a problem with the media, but the media plays some role in all this, and the media reflect what's happening in the minds of a lot of people in this country.
I would agree with that.
They're also exploited for pure financial reasons, obviously.
On this program, I encourage our listeners to become more conscientious about and take responsibility for their personal carbon footprint. I also ask them to think well before they make any decision that could negatively impact anyone else or themselves. There is a consequence to our thoughts, especially those that we act upon. But here we are as a society, as our other societies, the French, Great British, the Great Britain citizens, who send men and women into war, into conflict, without any construct to help them when they get out, to undo the post-traumatic stress disorder that many of them, if not the most, suffer from. As a consequence, there's about 23 people a day, 7 days a week, every single year since we went into Afghanistan. So we're talking about several hundred thousand American GIs have taken their life, and yet there's been no media coverage, nothing in Congress, nothing at the state level, nothing at the local level to help these men and women decommission and change the mindset that allowed them to survive in a conflict zone from the mindset necessary to coexist and harmonize with their family and friends. And we have all these hundreds of thousands of homeless vets killing themselves or going to jail or being cast out from society. Would you address this in your final comments, please?
Yes. In my work on Vietnam, which in the book I wrote, Home from the War, some time ago, actually in the early 70s, I talk about what I call an atrocity-producing situation in these counterinsurgency wars, beginning with Vietnam, but then including Iraq and Afghanistan and others. We fight a counterinsurgency battle, which can't be won except by atrocities. It's so structured militarily and psychologically that an ordinary person, no better or worse than you or me, would be capable of committing atrocities if thrust into that environment. Now, with any war, and there's much written about this long before Vietnam or World War II, there are profound effects on those who fight them. And it's always been a lot easier for countries to send young people, mostly young men, into war than to take care of them when they come back. But I think that in these atrocity-producing situations, there is a further dimension as what I called becoming both victims and executioners. And that becomes even more difficult to combat. And perhaps, or not so perhaps, certainly much of the reluctance of our country to take adequate care of these men when they come back, and now women too, has to do with, in doing that, one reveals so fully the nature of those wars, the atrocity-producing situation of those wars. In that sense, even though post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was just one of a number of people who advocated that we take on this kind of diagnosis. But post-traumatic stress disorder at least gives dignity to adult suffering. It isn't just a matter of childhood experience. It's what you're put through in an extreme situation that causes these effects. And although the term has been exaggerated and abused, like all terms, eventually, it's very useful and important in that way. And I think a society has to show its humanity to the extent that it has humanity in caring for people it has subjected to atrocity-producing situations.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that final comment. I do not believe, as a society, individually, yes, but as a society, my own personal experience interviewing over 1,000 of these men and women who've suffered and are, that society, not even their local neighbors, are showing that extension of care and love for these people. I thank you very much for all your good work, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, and also our audience should know that he is going strong at 90. You're 93 years of age, right?
Don't push it too high. I'll be 92 in May. So that's
92. Okay.
I'm still at it, yeah.
You're still at it. Good.
But I'm still at it.
No, good for you. And thank you for all your good work. And just so people who want to get his book, the book is The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind and Hope and Survival. His website is robertjlifton.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father.